This is Dr. Jay Corsandi, and you're listening to The Best Night Ever, the show that's dedicated to helping you get your best night's sleep. Over the last 20 years of treating patients, I've worn many hats, including dentist, engineer, psychologist, artist, corporate executive, and more. I've found that the key to success, health, and longevity lies in sleep, and that's why I created this show. I want to teach you how to make sleep your best friend. Join me on a journey to uncover cutting-edge science, life-changing tips from renowned experts, ancient and modern sleep secrets, game-changing routines, and lifestyle hacks that will educate, inspire, and ultimately help you get the best night ever. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. And if you are a regular listener, then you've heard me use the term biohacking fairly often. But what does it really mean, and is it being taken too far? In this episode, I have a great conversation with Elias Arjan, who is a personal friend and fellow health enthusiast. He's recognized as an expert in training, talent optimization, and business development, and he draws upon 25 years of experience as an entrepreneur, sales professional, actor, and speaker to develop high-performing leaders, teams, and organizations. He's also the Senior Vice President of BioStrap, which is an incredible sleep tracking tool that I personally use and we discuss about in the show as well. Speaking of what we talk about, in this show we'll learn more about his background from circus performer to corporate trainer, what he considers biohacking to be, the problems with biohacking and how some people take it too far, the path of the health enthusiast, why you would want to even be anti-fragile and what that means, his relationship with coffee, which is very unique, some of his sleep hacks, and this is coming from a senior executive of a sleep tracking company, and much more. We're also going to talk about the BioStrap, which is the company that he works for, and it is an awesome sleep tracker. I'll have a link set up on my personal page at sleepbiohacker.com where you can get an exclusive discount on the new upgraded version that they are releasing. So if you go to sleepbiohacker.com and scroll down, you will see it there among all the other products and things that I use to help optimize my health and sleep. And just follow the link there and you will be all set. You can also find me on Instagram at sleepbiohacker. That's sleepbiohacker. And if you want to jump on that platform and connect with me, I'd be more than happy to see you there. If you find this show helpful, please leave a review or share with a friend or two, or maybe even on a social media group that you may be in. I know I follow a lot of different groups on Facebook that are devoted to health optimization, and people are always asking for resources, topics, websites, or podcasts that can help them get better. And if you're on any of those, feel free to drop a link on my show. It's called Best Night Ever, and hopefully people can benefit. So now I invite you to sit back, relax, and enjoy the enlightening and entertaining conversation I have with Elias Arjan. All right, Elias, welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you, Jay.
Super excited to have you on here. I know we've been talking about this for a while. And I want to start off, I guess, with how we met. And I don't know if you know, but I think I was driving back from one of my clinics on the 405, and I was with my wife, and I told her, hey, fire up that Meetup app. Remember that app when people actually used to meet up in person?
Yeah, I know. It seems like so long ago. It's hard to believe we were, you know, having big groups of people gathering publicly.
It's crazy, right? I mean, it's like alien now. But I think we were just driving back, and I remember seeing something about a biohacking meetup in Santa Monica, and I was like, hey, look that thing up. It's on the way back. Let's go see if we can check it out. And she fired it up, and we found the event. It was in that hotel in Santa Monica.
Right.
And, you know, this was like maybe 2 years ago or something like that.
I don't know. A bit less. I think about a year and a half.
Maybe this last couple months have made time
extend out.
Crazy. Yeah. But yeah, it's been amazing ever since. You know, I'm really happy that we were able to connect that night. And then it's turned into a great friendship and camaraderie in the biohacking world. So Super excited to share your knowledge with everybody who's listening.
I know. I'm honored to be here. It's, you know, been a wonderful journey sort of leading that LA biohacking community, although I really miss everybody these days, you know, because we were very much focused, you know, we're doing 2 to 4 live events a month to zero all of a sudden. So
yeah, that's really bummed me out. I know we've done a couple online meetups with these virtual breakouts and things like that. Yeah. It's just not the same, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I've always been, you know, like a public speaker and a group organizer and like a live event producer. And so I have to admit, you know, my skill isn't running Zoom meetings, you know, that's not my forte. And I definitely feel the camaraderie that's generated from human to human contact is essential to basically being human. And, you know, taking it virtual, yeah, it doesn't translate in the way that we would hope it would, given the circumstances, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, we're lucky that actually we both live in LA and we're able to get in person again here, because I've done a lot of my podcasts over Zoom, and it's just the connection is bad and choppy, and even just like the whole vibe of the whole thing is a little bit different.
So. Well, I mean, if you think about it, you know, most, they say up to 90% of communication is nonverbal. And so there's things like nuances that we all have without even recognizing, just in terms of like eye contact and things that we feel from being in the same space as the individual, even things like pheromones that we don't even consciously recognize. The fact that the smell of the other person at an unconscious level, our brain is doing an analysis on how we read that person. And that's why some people will be like, I don't like the vibe of that person. They can't define what it is, but it's something in the tone of voice, their feel. It can even be the pheromone smell that they don't even consciously realize is actually driving that instinct. And so humans are a lot more instinctual and a lot more driven by intangibles. You know, we're not as rational and as cold as we often pretend to be.
And I knew that was the reason why I wanted you on the show here, just because of nuggets like that. So I know you mentioned a little bit of your background, but just for people listening, can you share a little bit of your journey, like where you were coming from? I know we were at a park event one day, and then you were barefoot, and my kids were there, and they were like, why is this guy barefoot? And then you started juggling for them as well. Right. So you've got quite an interesting background.
Yeah, it was an interesting journey. I think what happened was I came from, you know, if I'm going to try to summarize this quickly, but I came from a relatively, you know, poor family. So I thought, you know, the goal of my life would be to make money. So in college, I went to business and I took an elective in biology. And when I discovered how the human body worked, I had the like greatest epiphany of my life, where I just said, I want to understand more. And so I kind of dropped out of business school, went and started doing human performance, started working as a personal trainer, started competing as a triathlete. And, you know, the idea of human performance kind of became my life. And that segued into, from what I was doing physically in athletics, actually led me into things like acrobatics and juggling, and actually was a circus performer for a number of years, which people always are like, what, you know, because it's not maybe who I represent now, but I traveled the world as a touring circus performer. So that was an exercise in how do you optimize your performance while traveling, touring, doing up to 5 shows a day, performing in 100 degree heat for audiences of thousands of people at a time, and doing acrobatics 10 feet in the air above cement. So, you know, I learned a lot around what it takes to kind of perform at a very high level. And then I went back, surprisingly back, kind of into business, communications, marketing. And now I'm really fortunate. I work in the biohacking space, you know, sort of leading a community, working with other people who are sort of spreading that message. And I'm also the senior vice president with BioStrap. And then just prior to that, I was also doing my consulting company, Business Brain, which was a little more orientated around like psychometric performance, which maybe we can get into today. Because yeah. I think that's one of the pieces of biohacking that people are so into the biological side that they forget about the psychological piece.
So let's do this. Let's back up a little bit. And I know we love to throw the term biohacking around there. And I've mentioned it just about in every single show I talk about, but there's still people out there who don't understand what that is or what it means. So can you kind of give people your take on what biohacking is? And then we'll talk about the psychometric stuff as well.
So I think I like the term biohacking. I know there's some people who are trying to kind of even step away from it because it sounds a little subversive, shall we say, because the idea of hacking suggests like a subversive act.
Or like a negative thing.
Yeah. But I actually think that's okay, because if you look at the norms of our current society, the norm is we're okay with people having type 2 diabetes and comorbidities and cancer and diseases is just part of our society, you know? And I remember a year ago I was doing a talk and I was saying, you know, right now we're sitting around 50% of Americans have some form of chronic disease. And then when I started doing some talks in January of 2020, that number went up to 60%. And I just started saying, so now we're not only at half the population, but more than half the population has some form of chronic disease. And we're okay with that. That sounds like something that needs to be hacked. So that to me is part of what the biohacking movement is about, is this idea that we're not going to be okay with that. We're not going to submit to the social norm of illness being an acceptable choice. And we're going to hack the system and we're going to take back our own health. And we're not going to outsource our health to others who then decide whether we're sick or whether we're on pharmaceutical medications or, you know, so that to me is kind of what the biohacking movement represents. But it's actually a heavy lift. It's not, you know, dropping a tab of butter in your coffee in the morning.
And we're going to talk about that progression as well, too. I've got an interesting question here to see what you think about. But okay, so in the way I explain biohacking people is it's a multi-step process. And the first step is awareness, just like you mentioned. It's like understanding that there's a problem and realizing it and taking ownership for it. Then the other is actually doing the work or the optimization as needed. And there's a third part, which is, you know, tracking. And that's where we can talk about wearables and technology and metrics. So speaking of metrics, let's go into the psychometric stuff, because I was actually a psychobio major at UCLA in my undergrad. So I'm always fascinated with things of psychological nature.
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that I hear in the biohacking community and even health optimization, if you prefer that term, you know, or health personalization, which is all to me kind of synonymous, is the idea that, you know, there's a lot of physical work that's done, right? So let's track our heart rate or our heart rate variability or our look at our microbiome, how much am I sleeping? But, you know, fundamentally, the fact is that your psychological attitude towards success or towards health is going to define how your results, your outcomes, you know, and that's the whole thing about the placebo and nocebo effect. I mean, if you really want to think about it, the most effective drug on the planet is placebo, right? Yeah. So if you take a sugar pill and you believe, man, this is going to make me sleep like so well, and you truly believe it, guess what happens? You sleep better by taking a sugar pill.
Yeah.
So that's the power of the human mind.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the whole mindset and intention things as well, too. When I explore these spirituality type stuff, this is what comes to mind when I think of what I want to happen and how I want it to happen. So I totally get it. You have an interesting perspective on health optimization and biohacking. I know you have a much more critical approach, because for people who are listening who don't know, this world is inundated with all kinds of supplements and gadgets and technologies and companies popping up almost every day with promises of fantastic health and well-being and longevity and anti-aging. But a lot of these fall short of their claims. So what's your take on this whole, like, you're going to be great?
Well, I think, you know, if anybody is familiar with, or if you're not, I would suggest you go look at things like, you know, cognitive biases and how those work. And there's something that's a really popular cognitive bias, I think, in the biohacking world, is the, you know, magic pill fallacy. It's like, if I could only find the right supplement combination, like, I'm going to be optimized. Or if I can find the right little bits of technology, and that's okay. I mean, some of the biohacking community comes from people who are maybe even like hackers or technologists, you know, or quantifiers, and that's okay. But I think that's also one of the things that keeps the mainstream public from wanting to enter, because they feel like, well, it looks expensive and complicated, and it really isn't. I mean, if you look, a lot of it, sometimes the first stages of it is just kind of trying to be a little bit more like our hunter-gatherer ancestors. Get your feet on the earth, get more sun, breathe fresh air, go for a swim in the ocean in cold water. Like, these things cost nothing. Yeah. You don't need to spend $4,000 a month on technology and take 500 supplements to be a biohacker.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a proponent of both. I mean, I've got my infrared sauna, I've got my cold plunge, but I've also got outside and I've got the ocean. So, you know.
Well, the joke to me is that we're not going to become hunter-gatherers. So the irony is that we need to biohack, because we've created a society that is so far from nature that we need to biohack ourselves to get back to our natural self. Yeah. And technology does provide some necessary shortcuts there. And so I'm not against red light therapy by any means. I think, you know, that's great, or infrared saunas. All of that stuff is amazing. But I guess, you know, it also creates barriers for people. You know, I've been interviewed at a number of you know, magazines or articles that have been done. And, you know, one of the things that the journalists took away from one of them was like, you know, this is really for kind of the elites, you know, like the elite LA crew is spending a lot of money on health optimization and this is what they can do, but probably not for you. It was almost like one of the articles was written in that vein. And I think part of the whole thing we're trying to do with the Biohackers Collective and what I've even tried to do with, you know, our local community here in LA is make sure it's more accessible. So I guess that's just part of it, you know, because it doesn't have to be elitist completely. There's an element of that. Yeah. Like if you want to go there, you know, it is cool to get all that tech. And I guess my hope is that just like any technology, the early adopters will learn and develop and make the mistakes and spend the money. And eventually maybe it will become more ubiquitous and less expensive.
So for somebody who is new to all this and listening to us right now and going, what the hell are these guys talking about? Like, what would you say to them if they're interested? If they say, okay, I don't know what you guys are talking about, but I'm interested. What would be like a first step? Because I know here's the progression that I see amongst the circle that we know. You know, obviously, I think the gateway drug is probably this bulletproof fatty coffee, and then it gets into supplements, and then it gets into tech, and then it gets into gadgets, and then it gets into spirituality and plant medicine. It seems like that seems to be the progression I've seen all these different people go through. But for people who are, you know, just saying like, what the hell are all you talking about? Okay, I want to feel better. Where do they start?
So I think the challenge there is, I mean, I think one of the big things, like you said at the top, is like awareness. So, right. So start to educate yourself a little bit. And the key thing is to understand that biohacking is what's called like an N equals one experiment. Mm-hmm. And so what that requires is that N, for those you're not familiar with, is like the sum total of the research subjects is the N number. But we're doing N equals one, meaning that you as an individual are the sum total of your own research.
Yeah, and in traditional research, is the bigger the N, generally the better the predictable the data.
Yeah. So if we do a study with like 5,000 participants and you find the pharmaceutical drug has efficacy for, you know, the higher the number of those individuals, then you've proven that this drug actually will have an impact and it should go to market. But the thing that's great is that's great. Like, say you do that with 5,000 people, but let's say 1,000 of them don't have positive outcomes, right? We'll still release the drug. 1,000 of those people are going to have a horrible experience. They're going to have side effects. I mean, that's all the things you hear, the disclaimers on television, right? Can cause death. Oh, that's great. I think I'll, you know, I could either have like a sore knee or I could die.
I should talk to my doctor about this.
Yeah. So, you know, the N equals one is finding out for yourself. So I actually think, you know, although, you know, the keto diet or a lot of times, like you said, like the bulletproof diet or the keto diet or some sort of nutritional thing is often how people enter. I would kind of sometimes try to recommend people start with some type of self-test, even if it's subjective. Do I feel better when I eat more fat? Do I feel better when I'm more vegan? Do I feel better when I eat more carnivore? Do I feel better? What are, you know, at least monitor things like your energy levels or do like a nutritional diary on what are your emotional states? People don't even realize that food will completely impact your psychological state day to day. So if you're eating the wrong foods, you may be like in a very negative mental headspace or have brain fog and not know why. And not everybody can be any of these things. Like I hate to admit this, but for almost 20 years, I was vegetarian and I was doing
that. It's funny how prior vegetarians almost have a reluctancy to admit that they were vegetarian, but yeah.
Well, because I thought I was doing that because that was the right choice for the planet. That was the healthier choice for, you know, animal welfare and for my own health. And although I think it did work for me maybe when I was in my 20s, and as I got into my 30s, it started to have like negative impacts on my health gradually. So I had to start building in like, okay, I got to eat fish now. I got to start, like eventually I started putting in chicken. And then by the time I hit 40, I was like, and or into my early 40s, I just had to start eating meat. And now I'm at a point where I'm very keto and I found the right balance to tweak that. And my energy levels are higher today than they were 15 years ago because I've dialed in my diet.
Yeah.
And so I would never go to somebody now and say, oh, you should be keto. Because that's the other thing. People become evangelists for whatever works for them. So they biohack themselves and then they go out there.
You should take these supplements and do this. And
yeah, but it's an N equals one. So what the hell are you doing? Like you don't go and start, you know, becoming an evangelist for your path. You found your N equals one. Great. But don't expect, you know, I shouldn't be talking about as a 40-something-year-old male, I shouldn't be telling a 22-year-old female to follow my protocol. Like that's the dumbest thing in the world.
It's funny because in the sleep world, you know, I'm a sleep biohacker online and I see these people put up their sleep routines and protocols. And I look at them and go, if I did that, my sleep would be trash. Like, cause I have something that works for me specifically. Same thing goes with food as well. It's funny you mentioned the vegetarian thing, cause I was actually vegetarian and vegan for 2 years. Not much as much as you, but I kind of stopped eating meat. And then I started eating these imitation meats. And they were, you know, every time I ate them, there was this one, it was called citrus spare ribs. It was a Chinese spiced meat. I loved the taste of it, but every time I ate it, I would get these horrible stomach cramps. Yeah. And I felt like shit. And after a while, I was like, I don't want to eat this anymore. I don't feel good afterwards. But I didn't really make the connections until years later. And then I found it at a store and I flipped it over. I looked at the back and it said, the first thing it says, you know, wheat gluten. It's literally just balls of gluten with some soy sauce. And for me, you know, I didn't make the connection back then. And I tell people, I go, look, you know, when I was in undergrad or in dental school and practicing and learning, if someone gave me these nuggets then 20 years plus years ago, man, things would have been so different.
But we didn't know. I mean, the thing is when I was a personal trainer 20 years ago, we had three programs, right? Lose weight, gain weight, and maintain weight.
Yeah.
That was it. That was what we had is a personal trainer. That was the sum total.
Which one do you want?
Which one do you want? You want to gain weight, lose weight, or maintain weight? And we would design a program on those three parameters and then give them the food pyramid to eat.
Oh, yes.
And that was it. That was our toolkit. And I got certified as a personal trainer to teach that toolkit. And, you know, I did go through training. I did, you know, study things in college and, you know, but I don't think we had the breadth of understanding of the importance of personalization. And that's something that has really only come into greater and greater fruition in recent years, I think. We're still getting people educated on this.
So do you think there are things now in the health optimization world that we might look back on 10, 20 years from now and go, why the hell were we doing that now?
I think probably half or more of the technologies are just going to be kind of useless or irrelevant, you know, in 5 years. So now I think there's a lot of stuff, a lot of gadgets that, you know, maybe the hot gadget of the day, but, you know, have they been proven to have efficacy, you know, and are people going to still be using those things in 5 years? Probably not. And so I think we get a little we're a techno culture, right?
Like technophiles.
Yeah, technophile culture. So it's like, oh, the coolest new gadget. And there's that whole like fear of missing out.
FOMO.
The whole FOMO thing, you know, like, oh, if I don't have the latest supplement. So then you like, you know, you see people with like this cabinet of like 500 supplements.
Yeah.
And again, what I find amazing is, okay, you have 500 supplements or whatever, you spend $500 a month on supplements, which one of them works? Do you know? And when I ask that question, people just give me a blank stare. How do you know which? Have you tested your supplements? So you're spending $500 a month on supplement. What tests have you done to validate your supplement in your body? Yeah. Has it changed your biometrics? Has it changed your physiology? Has it changed your blood levels? Have you done a test baseline where you got your blood testing, then you do your intervention for a 30-day window, and that's experimentation. And then at the end of the 30 days, you would do a blood test again, and you would see that change my lipid levels, you know? And that's hard. I mean, but we're starting to have the technology, right? People are using continuous glucose monitors. Biostrap, we're using biometric testing. There's other wearables out there where you can do biometric testing. So the tools exist now for people to conduct N=1, but they also have to have the education to do it, the willingness, and even the time.
Yeah. I actually went to go visit a biological dentist a few weeks ago, and they're like, oh, we've got vitamin D finger prick test. I was like, how cool is that? I'm like, let's do it right now. So they actually just did a little finger prick on my finger, and they're like, this has a 90% correlation with actual blood draw. Mm-hmm. And I was like, this is perfect. And my levels were like 60, 62, I think. So I thought, I mean, that was even a step up from the old way of either going and having to order a blood lab order. Even there's some services online that you can order. I think Everly Well is a company, yeah. And you can prick your finger and then send it back. But this was like on the spot. It was just like a blood sugar test. It was amazing. So yeah. I'll have to give you the link to that. But that was really cool.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where this whole thing is ultimately going to be going, is that we're going to have, you know, we're going to have probably things where you can do like a finger prick test at home and scan it with your cell phone. And like, you know, you're going to get like an immediate, you know, readout of what, you know, what your blood levels are, you know, and there's just going to be a continuing development of that. And as it becomes more, you know, available, then more people will be able to do that N=1 type of work.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned this whole, like, you know, we all have to have the coolest and greatest and thing. it's kind of this lemming mentality. And it's funny because whenever something new comes on the market, people hit me up on social media, like, what do you think about this? Do you have this? Can you know what's your, and it's like, I got to have one. But a lot of these things, you know, I get access to them. And I think you get access to a lot of these as well. And some of them have shortcomings, you know, and I say to myself, you know, if I was spending real money on this, do I feel like I got what I was promised?
Right. Well, what's the ROI on that?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think also too, the other problem with this is to actually conduct true biohacking self-experimentation, you can only do one intervention at a time.
Yeah, they take the shotgun approach. And I've done that too. I'm admit, you know, I just like, you know, throw it all, stack, you know, they like to use this word stack.
Yeah, okay, well, you can do stacking. But again, you know, then if you're doing stacking, like, which is the thing that's actually having the impact, right? So you could remove five things out of the 10, you know, biohacking stack, and you would not have any change, right? Because there's five things that are good, and then five things that are having no effect, right? But you have no idea because you've just done all of this stuff and you've thrown it in one bucket.
So what do you think are like the pitfalls or the problems with biohacking? Like people jumping on board now, spending money, they don't have a clue what's going on, or?
I think it's just, the thing is a lack of testing. I think people should at least pick an area and start testing. I don't know, wherever that is, whether it's biometric testing, whether it's blood, you know, levels, whether it's microbiome testing is becoming big now. Although, just to warn everyone here that the microbiome testing is still in its pretty much in its infancy. So, you know, you kind of, although there's some companies making some pretty extravagant claims, I think we're still at the early stages of knowing even how the microbiome operates. And the science is moving very fast though, which is a good thing. I think microbiome can end up being one of the most important areas for us to have a strong understanding after genetics.
Yeah.
And so I think genetic testing is another thing, right? Because if you know you're genetic predisposed to certain conditions or, you know, situations that you maybe want to optimize yourself towards avoiding or increasing, you know, genetics is so there's an, you need to pick an area, start testing, and then start that experimentation path. Don't just jump in by buying stuff.
Yeah.
Oh. Test, baseline, then add interventions.
But I want the coolest thing. It's interesting because for me, a lot of this was kind of after the fact. Like, you know, growing up as a kid, and I've mentioned this before, I'm going, you know, to school, I'm riding the bus to school. My mom would give me cereal in the morning, you know, bowl full of sugar, you know, gluten and lactose. And my stomach would hurt on the way to school every day. Right. But I never made the connection. I just thought that's how it is.
Yeah.
You know, fast forward to now, you know, or at least, you know, even 10 years ago, I'm having a slice of pizza. I'm like, this is delicious, but I pay the price later.
Yeah.
Or even more recently, I was starting to take some supplements, getting my vitamin D levels up and taking B vitamins. And every time I took these vitamins, the B vitamins, I used to get kind of nauseous and these hot flashes and just felt disgusting and horrible. And then I realized genetic testing, oh, I've got MTHFR mutation, which means I can't process certain B vitamins.
Yeah.
So, okay, once I made these connections and then validated them with these different protocols, it's like, okay, you know, I need to know more. That's how I guess you go down this whole rabbit hole of, you know, once you start putting pieces together, like, oh my God, what else can I discover?
You kind of have to become your own doctor.
Fortunately for me, it's great because I am a doctor.
Yeah,
but for people who aren't, how do they navigate this?
So I think, you know, I think the reason they always say people freeze in the face of abundance of choices.
Yes.
Right? So there's too many things to do for some people. Some people will just like look at the biohacking world and run the other way as fast as they can because there's like, it's just too much. It's like total information overload. So, you know, I mean, let's talk about some really simple things that people can just dial in, right? Which is, you know, something say as basic, as fundamental to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We all sleep a third of our lives, mm-hmm. right? I know that's a big thing that you talk about on this podcast,
yeah.
right? Like it's all about sleep. So, you know, that's something people need to dial in. Like, what is you doing? What's your sleep, you know, plan? So, you know, you kind of have these sleep, right? Nutrition and exercise. Those yeah. are like what I get the three virtues.
I call them the three pillars. Yeah.
The three virtues, you know, is what I call them. And so you have to have those things dialed in. Even if you don't do anything else, you know, but the nutrition one is the most complicated because it's, again, that's the N equals one. Like you said, you found out you couldn't process B vitamins. You didn't know that. People will be taking a vitamin, not realizing it's having that negative impact on them. I know for me, one of the biggest moments of clarity in my entire life came in two phases. First, when I got off gluten and brain fog disappeared. And the thing about brain fog is it literally is a fog. You're living in a fog and you don't know the fog is gone until it clears. Yeah. And then you wake up one day and you look out and the world is crisper. It's clear. You can see and feel and smell and perceive in a richer, more refined way.
It's like HD TV.
And you suddenly realize, oh my God, I didn't know this was reality. Yeah. I was having an experience behind a layer of fog, and this is what the world really is. And that to me is something that I've had happen when I've dialed in my nutrition, but it's taken me like decades now to do that.
And I think a lot of people are looking for overnight solutions. They're like, oh, I'm just going to pop the supplement and tomorrow's going to be a whole new day. It doesn't work like that.
I wish it did. I mean, that's the thing that drove me crazy. That's kind of what even got me into this, because when I was a personal trainer, my clients expected me to kind of transform them overnight.
Miracle worker.
Yeah. And then I would work with them. I would try to coach them. I would try to offer them everything I had. And like I said, my toolkit, looking back now, was very limited. But I remember I was in college and there was a woman who actually was my professor who inspired me to even get into triathlons. And she was a triathlete. She was this amazing professor. And I went to her one day and I said, oh, I'm like a total failure as a personal trainer. I'm a disaster. I should just quit. And she's like, well, what happened? And I said, well, you know, out of like every 10 people I train, you know, only about 3 or 4 of them stick with it. After like, you know, because I was looking, I went back and I looked at all my clients over the previous like 6 months. And I looked at how many people still were actively following the programs and had maintained their memberships at my gym. And I realized my success rate was about 30 to 40%. And I took that to my professor and like total like self-disgust, like I'm a total failure. I should just give it up. And she says, that's amazing. You're an incredible trainer. So what do you mean? She goes, the average number of people that maintain a fitness program over time is less than 10%. And that's people who've already bought a gym membership, self-identified that they want to see a personal trainer, and are still there 6 to 12 months later. 10%, 10 out of 100.
Yeah. That's why I always said I should open a gym.
Yeah. Because you make all this money off the recurring memberships and people will never show up.
That's right.
And so that's when I kind of, that was what got me into biohacking, in the sense that at that moment I had an epiphany. I said, like, why do people fall off the wagon? You know, like, what is that? And that's where I feel like the mental piece comes in, right? Because even if you find people a good solution, do they stick with it?
Yeah, it's funny. I was just on a webinar and there's a company out there that is an app that basically is a accountability for fitness. And basically you have an online coach that you check in with and they track your fitness through wearables. And then they're like, okay, now you're held accountable. You need to continue to do the work. I'm watching you remotely and people get better and they stick with it and makes sense to me.
Yeah. That, I mean, I think that's actually kind of what is necessary. Like that's why, you know, that's why I think the whole field of personal coaching has taken off.
Yeah.
Because you need, as human beings, our natural orientation of our brain and our behavior is actually quite lazy. You know, our default state is lazy in a way. And even if the best of us, right? Like even the people who don't think that of themselves, the people who aren't lazy are just because they've developed some mental strategies to overcome that limitation.
Yeah.
But it's like our default mental state is to kind of come back to your very easy baseline. And so it takes continual effort, accountability, and inspiration to maintain a direction towards growth and change.
All right, let's change gears a little bit. I know you mentioned this at the beginning of the show, your connection to BioStrap, which is a wearable. I guess you can kind of expand a little bit on the whole idea of wearables, biometrics, and what your company is aiming to do.
Well, I mean, I think, again, part of this whole N equals one is that, you know, for decades, athletes, you know, you see these images in their minds, people probably have this of an Olympian in a gym, you know, with the chest strap and the headband and the VO2 max thing on their face, and they're hooked up to this like huge machine and they're running on a treadmill and their coach is there with a clipboard, you know, monitoring all of those biometrics.
I can actually just see that in my head right now. It's funny.
You know, and then they're kind of saying, okay, you know, for you to win the Olympics, you got to do this and you got to do that and you got to do this other thing. So we all have that image. And all that's happened now is that big, all that technology that used to be in that Olympian's lab is now available on a wrist-worn wearable. And so we can look at the same things that cardiologists and exercise physiologists have been using, you know, in the hospital or in the lab at home. And, you know, so BioStrap tries to kind of replicate that lab experience and really focusing it more on nocturnal metric collection. This is another piece that people miss. Like a lot of people have an Apple Watch and they click it at 2 o'clock and say, hey, look, my heart rate is 97 beats a minute. Okay. What does that mean? It's a snapshot, you know, of a moment in time and where your heart rate is at. That actually doesn't mean a bloody thing, because what means something is trends over time and predominantly how your biometrics change nocturnally. Because as you talk about on the show, sleep is the area where all the good stuff happens, right? If you're not getting the good stuff at sleep, kind of nothing else matters ultimately.
Right. And it's also indicative of what happened throughout the day, because yes, if you ate bad, if you got a bunch of bad light exposure, it's going to reflect on your sleep performance as well too. So it's a window to what you're doing throughout the day. And it's also an opportunity or a disadvantage if it shows up worse at night.
Yeah. And so that's where that whole self-experimentation becomes really powerful, because it's like, oh, and also too, just even that knowledge starts to change behavior, because people start to become their own accountability partner. It's like, oh, I binged watched Netflix till like 2 a.m. and then I went to bed and I had like no deep sleep last night. You know what I mean?
I wonder why. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you kind of go, oh, you know, if I go to bed at 2 a.m. after binge watching TV, my deep sleep is like less than 10%. Whereas if I go to bed, you know, at, you know, 10:30 and I don't, you know, expose myself to any blue light after dark and everything else, also my deep sleep is like 35%. So you start to go, wow, I didn't realize that that would make that big of a difference. So because, again, the subjective experience often in our go-go culture is I'm going to suck it up and fight through the day, no matter how I feel. And then we wonder why people drop dead of heart attacks, right? Because that's our attitude. It's our attitude isn't let's optimize our recovery and sleep and feel good all the time. Our psychology of our culture is I'm going to get shit done no matter how much pain it causes me. And we glorify that as if that's like the most beautiful thing in the world. And I mean, it is inspirational. You know, when you see an Olympian performing at an event with a broken ankle and they still complete the routine or they complete the race, we all cheer and we go, my God, that's amazing. But that's not the way to live every day of your life.
You know, it's interesting because for me, like you said, these biometrics and these wearables, it's about lifestyle modification, because it's about taking information and subjective experience and connecting the dots, putting them together. Like you said, you know, having a late dinner, having 4 glasses of wine, you know, seeing the impact it has on me, you know, on an app, on a phone, on the data, and also subjectively, hey, I feel like crap today. Well, you know, maybe I shouldn't do what I did the night before. And, you know, conversely, I'm a big fan of hot yoga until they shut down during this whole pandemic. But almost 100% of the time when I would go and do one of those sessions in a 115-degree room and sweat my ass off and go through these crazy postures, those nights I would sleep like a champion, like off the charts numbers. And I go, wait a second, this is helping me sleep. I feel better. I have less pains and aches. I'm performing more. Maybe there's more to it. So it becomes a positive reinforcement.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that people need to start to recognize is putting these things together, you can then get better.
Yeah. And then what I think is really exciting is one of the metrics that BioStrap and some other wearables have added in is heart rate variability.
Yeah. Let's talk about HRV, because I've done a bunch of podcasts on, including the one with one of the chief scientists at HeartMath. And it still fascinates me. And some people, it can be a bit of a nebulous concept to grasp, but what's your take on heart rate variability?
I mean, as someone who has some experience in, you know, human biology and physiology, you know, HRV is definitely a quagmire, because it's not a this equals that equation like so many other things. Like, we know that if you're an athlete, you're going to have a low resting heart rate at night, and low resting heart rate is good because it just means that your cardiovascular system is just more efficient at pumping blood. And so, you know, you have, you know, some of these incredibly athletic people and they have, you know, the resting heart rate's like, you know, high 30s, you know, it's just insane, but they're so efficient. But HRV is also inverse, right? Higher is better, but it doesn't always even imply better, you right. know? Like,
and that's
not, it's not this thing like where you can just say this is good and this is bad. It's relative to the individual. It's trends over time. Certain stressors can actually increase HRV because you put your body in a parasympathetic activation to deal with the stress, which is almost counterintuitive, right? But that's part of some people's neurophysiology, you know, is going to change things. So HRV is not as clean a metric. And so I think that's one of the reasons why it's not as widely used.
Yeah. I mean, I've tried to quote unquote hack my HRV. It's funny because, you know, mine's pretty low, but where I'm at and my wife's is like over 100. It's like 120. And she's like, haha, I'm so much better than you. I'm right. like, no.
She's like, I don't even need the biohack. I'm already there. You know, what are you wasting your time with that junk for? Right.
So. It's crazy. But yeah, it's an interesting one. I guess one way I've heard it described as it's a way to see into vagal tone. And I don't right. know how much you are into vagus nerve stuff. I'm actually going to be doing a podcast coming up with a doc that wrote a book on it, but right. I'm trying to understand that pathway as well.
Right. So, well, vagal tone is that parasympathetic activation, right? So, I mean, the thing, for those of you not familiar with HRV, I mean, all of us are impacted by our autonomic nervous system. It's if you have a nervous system, this is impacting you. There's no like, oh, that doesn't qualify for me. Like, that's why I like things like HRV, because it's something that everyone has to consider, you know, to a certain degree. It's not unique. It's not N equals one. It's true for everybody. So you're either in the sympathetic, fight or flight, right? Where you're in this state where your body, you know, is getting you ready to fight or flight. So you're going to have, you know, elevated heart rate. You're going to have the blood going from the torso into the extremities so that you can fight or run. You know, your digestion is going to slow down or stop in that state to protect the body. And then if you have high vagal tone and you've gone to rest and digest, and then all of a sudden, that blood now goes from the extremities to your torso, is collecting more blood in the lungs, is helping with digestion, is helping, you know, clean the body because you're in a state of rest and digest. And if we don't get there, which I think in our always-on culture, people are answering business calls 5 seconds before they put their head on the pillow, and then they wonder why they're not getting into a parasympathetic state.
With the racing mind and we're going to talk a little bit about bedroom hacking because we were talking before off mic about what we do to set the room up. But when it comes to these biometrics, one of the issues or pitfalls that I've had challenges with, and I'm sure many people have, is seeing all these numbers and wanting to hack them all and get them all perfect. Like for me, it's like I get frustrated and aggravated. I can't get my HRV higher. I know my sleep scores are great, which is great, but do you think there's a problem? I think it's called orthorexia, like as far as sleep. But even for other numbers, it's like, do people start getting obsessed about how do I get this higher? Or the other issue is people checking these numbers every day and going, well, you know, today my number says I slept a 95, but I feel like I slept a 50. So are there discrepancies as well too between the subjective and the objective?
I mean, this is a big question.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I saw this actually posted on, I think it was like a Facebook forum for biohacking. And they said, at what point does biohacking become like a mental disorder?
Yeah. ADHD
Or just you just get too into the self-quantification to the point like you kind of, you know, gone off the rails, right? And you're just completely obsessed now and you won't do anything or think anything, or you can't let yourself have like a single piece of chocolate and cream, you know, because it's like, oh, that's going to break. I'm outside my eating window. Yeah. Like, I'm not going to do it. So I think human beings actually are designed to be creatures of leisure. Again, if we go back to our ancestors, our hunter-gatherer ancestors probably worked like 4 hours a day.
Oh man, I want to go back to that.
You know, and the rest of the time was spent like leisurely hanging out with their friends and singing and dancing and cooking by the fire and in community, procreating. Like that's actually what our nervous system wants, is for us to be in a state of vagal tone.
Yeah.
So if we don't relax and chill out a bit, you know, we are going to get sick even if we're trying to prevent ourselves from being sick. So I think there's a point of diminishing returns where you need to also just chill out.
All right, folks, you heard that here. You all need to just chill out. I know we talked a little bit about the gateway to biohacking. For me, it was, you know, this bulletproof coffee, this fatty coffee. I think you mentioned before you've never had a cup of coffee. Is that
right? I've never drank a cup of coffee my entire life.
So what's with that?
It's actually just kind of a funny story, I guess. When I was in high school, when where a lot of times people start picking up coffee, and I was like cramming for exams, and like somebody handed me a cup of coffee and says, here, drink this. This will help you study. And like I took a sip and I spit it out immediately. I said, this tastes like crap. And they said, yeah, but you'll get used to it. And I said, okay, I'll get used to it. Is it good for me? They said, no. I said, and they said, oh, and it's addictive. And I said, well, forget it then. It tastes like crap, but it's addictive. So I'm just not going to do it. And so I never picked up coffee. I just like it never became part of my life.
And that's funny coming from the guy who's the head of the Biohackers Collective, which is, you know, coffee is like the god of biohacking.
Well, I think I know that people are into, I mean, coffee, caffeine is a nootropic, right?
Yes.
For sure. And I've been experimenting actually a little bit recently with different forms of caffeine just for my own performance. And I do have to admit, because especially because I don't drink coffee, so I'm so sensitive to caffeine, that if I ingest any caffeine in, you know, other forms, it does activate me. Like I can go do like a killer workout. But what I do is I'll look at my BioStrap recovery score when I'm at an excellent, meaning that I should do like as intense a workout.
You should push harder.
I can push as hard as I can. Then I'm going to use some caffeine, because that caffeine is also going to drive my nervous system and raise my energy level, so I can actually push myself a little bit harder in that workout than I normally would. But again, one of the things, this brings up something else I'd like to talk about, is the idea of cycling. That I think is often missing. People will take the same supplement every day for years.
Yeah.
That's not a good idea.
Yeah.
For anyone listening, and you've been doing that, so you drink coffee every day, that's your body becomes conditioned to any external input. So if you drink alcohol and you start with one glass of wine, well, guess what happens? After a little while, you need two glasses to get the same effect. Then you need three glasses to get the same effect. Then it's true with coffee. It's true with supplements. The body is lazy. And if you make it easy, so I take melatonin supplements every night, the body's going to go, oh, I don't have to produce melatonin. You're just going to bring it externally. I take a break. Mm-hmm. It's lazy. It's just going to stop producing that level of melatonin for you because you've taken the responsibility away.
Yeah. This whole cycling thing is interesting because I think that has to do with just about everything, you know, whether it's keto diet, it's like, you know, people are like keto for life, you know, I'm never touching carbs again, or supplements, or any kind of health optimization. Even for me, you know, yeah, I've been mostly keto. I've done a ton of intermittent fasting, and I've gotten to a point where I'm, you know, metabolically flexible. Like if my kids are having some spaghetti at night, you know, it has to do, like you said, a little bit with placebo and mindset and intention. It's like, you know, if I'm going to have a piece of pizza, I'm going to say, okay, you know what? I'm not going to die. And, you know, I've become resilient enough to be able to handle it. And no big deal, you know?
Well, that brings up a concept that I think is really important to some people in the biohacking community, but maybe everybody can consider for a minute, is the idea of being anti-fragile. I mean, the whole reason the world is locked down right now is because we're so fragile that a virus, and human beings have been coexisting with viruses for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, but we have now become so fragile. And I mean, I'm not saying this isn't a very dangerous virus. It is. But the idea of being anti-fragile is that I am so resilient, you can throw anything at me and I can handle it. So I can eat gluten and not die. I can run up a mountain, or I can lift a rock and I have the strength to do that. Like I can do any of these different things with a high level of metabolic and physiological and even neurological flexibility, meaning that, you know, you say a bad word to me and I don't hate myself and go into your depression. Now, again, I'm not minimizing that a lot of people suffer from many different things and struggle with this. But I think to me, ultimately, the goal that has become part of my life now is thinking a little bit more in that term. It's not always about optimizing. It's about what do I do to kind of confuse my neurophysiology so it never knows what it's going to face next, mm-hmm. so that I'm so anti-fragile that you could put me in the middle of a leper colony and I feel like I'm confident that I'm going to overcome it. And maybe that's a bit of an extreme approach. That's kind of where I'm sitting right now.
Yeah.
And maybe this pandemic has made me even think about that more.
It's funny because I've also adopted that mentality of kind of always keep the body guessing.
Yeah.
And generally, even for when it comes to sleep, I always say, you know, try to go to sleep at the same time, wake up at the same time. But even every now and then, maybe once or twice a week, I'll change up my sleep routine. I'll go to sleep a little later and I'll wake up a little later or go to sleep a little earlier. And that seems to just regulate better.
I mean, if anybody remembers, in the there was a big fitness trend that came out a little while ago, like there's a PX90, which is a muscle confusion. That's actually true. Like if you do a different type of, so if you do the same if you do the same type of weightlifting, what does your body become good at? Weightlifting.
Yeah.
And I remember a funny thing. At one point in my life, I taught yoga and I had these guys come in who were kite. I was living on the beach, another part of my life. I was living on the beach in the Caribbean, right next to a kite surfing beach. And these kite surfers came in. I don't know if you've seen kite surfers. They're standing there with their arms extended all day on a board for like 6-8 hours a day. And they're all ripped because of the way they're using their bodies and they're in the sun and like all this stuff. So they're ripped. And then I would get them to try to do like upward dog and their shoulders were so tight from being a kite surfer, they couldn't do the most basic yoga postures. But to look at them, you would think, man, these guys are in such incredible shape. They couldn't, 10 minutes into yoga class, they were falling over because they couldn't hold a position for even like the slightest amount of time because their bodies were trained to be kite surfers, not yogis.
Yeah.
So if you do the same thing all the time, you just become at that good at that thing.
Yeah.
And that's part of our culture too, is we become experts, right? Everyone's an expert, but in one thing.
Yeah.
But I think my diversity is strength, right? If you mix it up, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah. That's what I enjoy. This stuff that we do is, you know, it's about mixing up. It's about experimentation. It's about having fun. It's about not taking it too seriously. At the end of the day, you know, life is short. I know that's a cliche term, but it really is. Time flies. And while we're on here, let's make the best of it versus just kind of going through the paces.
Yeah. I think the fun element, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because I mean, that's something I think that is maybe not always talked about.
No, a lot of people get too serious about it. Yeah,
and I'll tell you one of the things from a psychological standpoint that can be useful is just celebrate your small wins, right? Yeah. Like, you know, if your biometrics change, like, woohoo, you know, like, and I see people doing that on social media too. Like, celebrate your successes because that's also too how you drive inspiration and motivation. So make sure it's not always like you're immediately looking to the next mountain to climb. Like when you get to the top of the first mountain, like, really celebrate and be proud of yourself and be happy and take a moment to give yourself some oxytocin as a reward, you know, and not always be so driven.
And now we're getting into the whole mindfulness and presence, which is a whole different thing. And I do a lot of that. And I've done a lot of shows on meditation and it's something that I've incorporated. I talk to people about morning routines. And, you know, one of the things I do is, you know, I'll try and get in a 15-20 minute session in the morning. Mindset. It's kind of how you approach the world. I'm a big fan of that. And I think this is all interrelated. We're getting closer to the end of the show, but I want to talk about a few more things. One of them that we were talking about before the show was kind of the sleep sanctuary, what I call it. And that's how I've kind of set up my room. How do you have your room set up to get yourself some good sleep?
I'm sure you've had a lot of people on the show like go deep into this. I mean, just for me personally, just kind of we do the simple things, you know, it's very dark, it's very cool. It's an electronics-free zone. It doesn't have a lot of distractions and we use the room only for sleep and other extracurricular activities.
Yeah.
But it's not like you don't go in there and work on your computer at night. You know, we don't watch TV and we don't have a TV in there. You know, that sort of thing. Like you keep it as that sanctuary. It's the place where you go to sleep. We have a really nice big, you know, king-size bed. And just kind of keep it even minimalist in there. You know, it's kind of a little zen. You know, there's not a lot of things to like visually even create distractions. And for me, my house looks like a submarine after dark.
Yeah, I tell people my house looks like the Amsterdam red light district.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's funny because we moved to a new very residential neighborhood recently. And I'm sure our neighbors must think there's something weird going on because if like once the lights go down, you know, it's only red lights in our house.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's something that I just have adopted. And I just like, I can't even think about like when I turn on a regular light at nighttime, I just feel my brain now get like activated in a negative way.
Yeah. It's funny. I'm the same too. Everything turns to red at night and I'll accidentally flip a switch with some white. I have different switches, red switches and white.
Yeah.
And I'll flip a white one at the wrong time. And it's almost like, what is that? Dracula or it's vampires when they hit sunlight in their face and like,
Yeah.
So,
or gremlins. I don't know if you remember gremlins
with the water.
They were like, bright light.
bright light.
Yeah. So it's like that. I'm just kind of like, oh, I can't take it, you know? So,
and for people listening, what we're even talking about, I guess it has to do with, you know, light exposure at night and melatonin, blue light blocking glasses. I've talked about, you've obviously played with. Have you noticed differences in sleep if you wear those?
I think for me personally, my own N=1, I haven't noticed that many gains. The only time I consistently wear those is when I'm flying through different time zones.
Yeah, jet lag hacking. And I've done a couple of shows on that. Yeah, that's a big one.
That's the only time I consistently use my blue light blockers is I usually put them on from the time I leave home to the time I arrive at my destination on the plane and the airport. I mean, I just do that to minimize it.
What is this airport word you speak of in planes?
Well, I mean, in the past, we're not doing that now, but that's still, that was kind of the only time I consistently found the glasses to be impactful because now at home I can optimize.
You can mimic the environment as needed. Yeah. So for people listening out there, one of the easy tricks you can do is get yourself some red light bulbs and flip them on at night instead of your regular lights. I think that's an easy one. That's a fun one too, because then who doesn't want to be in an astronomical environment, right?
Yeah, it's kind of romantic, you know, if you're there and you have like a red light space and, you know, you're with your spouse or, you know, having even friends over for a party, it's kind of got a cool feel, a vibe, you know, so it's kind of a nice hack. I agree. It's like a very fun, easy one to do.
Yeah, there you go. So that's an easy one. So speaking of hacks, and we've talked a lot about that word and a lot of different things, and, you know, both of us have, you know, lived, you know, a decent amount of life. Taking all you've kind of learned so far, if someone was to come to you and say, hey, I want to be better, feel better, get better, improve my life, what would be like a couple things you would tell them to explore or do?
I mean, it does have to be, I'd probably ask at least, you know, two or three questions to try to get to know the person a little bit better. You know, again, probably looking at those kind of three virtues, you know, where is their sleep, where is their activity levels, and where is their nutrition? You know, and I would look at, you know, making some, and again, the thing too is a lot of times these things can be just like little micro changes. Like I've become really into this idea of like micro optimization. Like I'm even doing these
like micro-dosing? No. Well, another word
That's part of it. But I guess for me, like what I started to do, because I'm at home now, right? We're working from home. I built a home gym in my garage, and it's also my office. So sometimes when I'm on Zoom calls, I'm just there audio and I'm muted and I'm doing like chin-ups on a bar. You know what I mean? When I'm on a Zoom call or just stretching. So I'm doing these things where, you know, you can just do these little things. Like you can just, when you have a moment and you're typing at your computer for an hour, take 5 minutes and just do some torso rotations and stretch up your back, lift your shoulders up, take some pause and do 3 minutes of box breathing. You know, these little things that you do actually will have tremendous impact on your life. And then what happens, because you start to feel better doing these small things, these things will grow. So if that's where I would tell people to start, is don't think, I suddenly got to go off sugar, I got to stop eating gluten, I got to work out 6 times a week. Like that's why diets fail and 90% of people drop out of the gym, is because they try to push themselves beyond, like our human psychology is kind of like a rubber band. Mm-hmm. So if you stretch it too far, it will either snap or will want to bounce back to its original shape. But if you slightly start to stretch it bit by bit, it becomes more flexible. So what are the little things you can start to do to tweak it, get a success there, move on to the next thing? Small steps, I guess.
Baby steps.
It's classic, right? Classic baby steps.
That makes perfect sense. And it literally is a matter of just modifying small things. I mean, I think I've seen some research articles that said, you know, I'm doing a couple squats every hour is better than going to the gym for 1 hour straight.
Yeah, actually, one of the things that has become, like I've seen online, these challenges, which are like 100 push-ups a day or 100 squats a day. And it doesn't mean you do 100 squats. It means like you get up in the morning, you do 10. And then you have breakfast and then you do 10. And then you like work for an hour and then you do 10.
Yeah.
And you just spread that out throughout the day. And if you do that every day for a month, people are showing like tremendous changes in their physiology just from doing that.
Yeah.
Like that's a perfect example of what I'm talking about here, is like, that's all you got to do.
I think that's great advice. So obviously the movement component or the exercise would be, you know, baby steps there. As far as food goes, again, like you said, just make some small modifications and start building up from there, obviously.
You know? And also finding what works for you. Like that's, nutrition is really tough, I have to admit. It's the, and you know, I've read a lot of studies on this, and it's actually easier for a person to change anything, political affiliation, their spouse, their religion, than it is to get them to change their diet.
Wow.
That's how deeply, because our gut bacteria,
they're the ones calling the shots.
They are communicating to your brain. Mm-hmm. And when they start dying, they tell you, you feel like you're dying because your gut bacteria is saying, I'm dying. I'm going to make you feel it. And so that like bad gut bacteria that you want to get rid of is making you think that you're starving yourself to death and you got to keep eating that stuff. If, especially if you're like really addicted to sugar or something that's bad for you. And that's why when people do these sugar cleanses, it takes like a tremendous amount of psychological and physiological effort to overcome that. So nutrition is very tough. So that's why I say maybe activity and sleep, get some wins.
Yes, get some wins, easy wins, low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
For nutrition, for me, I've noticed the bigger changes I've noticed is eliminating things that make me feel worse. I've noticed less impact on finding things that make me feel better. I don't know if that's just how people generally are, but that's how I work.
I know one of the things that I think was also a really mind-opening thing for me, having studied a lot of nutrition in my life, that I hadn't really heard until I got a bit more into, I guess, the more modern biohacking over the last sort of, you know, half decade or so, was not even so much what I ate, but when I ate.
Yeah.
And so I have to admit, like for myself, intermittent fasting, I mean, and again, I know it doesn't work for women. A lot of women it doesn't work for. A lot of individuals it doesn't work for. But for myself, at a man, at the age I am, the intermittent fasting is like a total game changer for me. Because by just creating, you know, that 18-6 eating window, I can kind of almost get away with a lot of things that probably I couldn't get away with otherwise if I want to. But it's because I'm giving myself only a 6-hour eating window. And I know that's extreme. Not everybody has to do this. But for me, man, that gives me so much energy because I've entered the state where I've trained my body to be in ketosis and metabolically flexible. And I mean, I just feel so much energy. I love it.
Yeah. And it's funny because people look at me and go, oh, you're the skinny guy. I go, no, man. You know, I used to weigh 30 plus pounds more. Obviously, I've worked to get to where I'm at. But even during this whole lockdown, I admit, you know, I was snacking probably more than I should be and eating some stuff I shouldn't have been. But because of the work I've done in the past, you know, I was able to kind of write it off. It wasn't a big impact either on me mentally, physically. I mean, I got to eat some goodies. You know, I had my cake and I got to eat it too.
I think that brings up, you know, you asked me this. I think I just want to return this idea that I think kind of anybody can benefit from fasting is a way to become anti-fragile. Because the first time you do a fast is when you face all of the psychological and physiological barriers to change. You start feeling like, I'm going crazy. I have to eat.
I'm going to die.
I'm going to die if I don't get food in my face. And like all of this stuff, all of this emotional stuff comes up.
Yeah.
And once you're on the other side of that and you realize like, I didn't die. I faced kind of my fear, you know, and like it says in Dune, you know, fear is the mind killer. You face your fear, you go through it, you come out the other side, and then you realize, you know what? I can do that again.
Yeah.
And that's another place to get a win.
And next thing you know, you're jumping into an ice chest freezer full of 32 degree water.
Yeah. Well, hey, man, I'm originally Canadian and I've always hated the cold. So like that's one of the hacks that like I'm not as down with as you are, you know, and it doesn't work as well for me just because I think maybe I have a psychological block there or something. Yeah. But again, N equals one, right? Like you don't have to do all of them. Find the ones that you know, are the best for you.
All right. Well, this has been a fun one here, kind of more of like a fireside chat. And I like that. You know, a lot of the stuff we've talked about or I've talked about in the show in the past has been very, you know, specifically oriented gadgets or tech or supplement. But, you know, we just kind of covered a whole bunch of different topics. I hope people got some good takeaways from this. I want to thank you for joining me. This has been a lot of fun. For people who want to go and learn more about you or BioStrap, where could they go?
Well, I have my own website, eliasairjan.com, which I have a little tab for biohacking, but I'm probably going to improve that, you know, make it a little bit more biohacking orientated. BioStrap.com is obviously the company I work with. And my consulting firm is BusinessBrainLLC.com. That's where I talk about psychometrics. And it was more about optimizing performance for companies and teams and large organizations, which is still a big passion of mine. that's kind of it. And I really appreciate you having me, Jay. I hope this wasn't too all over the place for your listeners. I mean, it was a little erratic, but I hope people, you know, get some useful insights.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks again for being on my show. And yeah, man, looking forward to hanging out with you more and getting back to this whole LA Biohacker Collective scene and connecting with everybody.
Oh yeah, biohackerscollective.org.
Biohackerscollective.org, people. Maybe. If you're local, you know, feel free to reach out to us there or to me on my Sleep Biohacker site, and I can connect you as well too. We'd love to get some more people to come on board, right?
Yeah, definitely. And cool. Then there's chapters around the world at Biohackers Collective.
That's right. It's so, not just LA, right?
Yeah. So there's different chapters. I mean, I think everyone's a little bit inactive right now. I saw our Toronto chapter had a first live event and I was like so jealous because they were free to do a live event, opened up there in Toronto. So I'm waiting for us to be able to do that here in LA.
Cool. All right. Elias, thanks again for joining me. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Dr. J.
All right, and that's another wrap. What did you think about this episode? Feel free to reach out to me on my website at sleepbiohacker.com, where you can contact me directly, or on Instagram at the same name, sleepbiohacker. I'm always interested in hearing what people think about my show and the topics that we talk about, or if you have ideas about other topics that you'd like for me to explore or guests that you'd like for me to have on, as I'm always looking for very interesting and unique perspectives on how to optimize our health and our lives. And again, if you are interested in the BioStrap that we talk about, it is pretty special and it's something that I use every night to track my sleep. And now is your chance to get in on the discount pricing. All you have to do is go to my website, sleepbiohacker.com, scroll down, you'll see the different tools and tricks and supplements and gadgets, and BioStrap is one of them there. And there is a link that you can click on. It will take you to a special link on their site where you will have exclusive pricing on the newest version. And lastly, this show is brought to you by me. And if you feel like helping me out or find this show beneficial, please share this with a friend or two. You can use any share feature on the podcast apps out there or throw it on a social media link and tag me so I know that you people are out there and enjoying this. And with that, it is my pleasure to wrap this show up. And as always, I hope you have the best night ever, and I will see you all very soon.
This broadcast is for informational purposes only. Statements and views expressed in this show are not medical advice. The show, including Dr. Jay Corsandi, the co-host, guest, and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of any information contained herein. Opinions of the guests are their own. We do not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests, nor do we make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. If you think you have a medical problem, please consult a licensed physician.